Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners. In this episode, we're going to be talking about near deaths in male prisons in England, which is certainly not the happiest topic. So please be aware that there may be some issues that people might find difficult to deal with. Justice Studio has done a few projects in adult male prisons. For example, in 2017, we did an evaluation of some interventions that were happening in a Category C training prison, and helping to understand what improvements this project was making for the prisoners and also the staff who were working at that reform prison. And then in 2020 to 2022, all the way through the COVID-19 pandemic, we were supporting as a critical friend the Prison Reform Trust on a really interesting project looking at how to improve the hope and the well-being of people who are on long-term prison sentences. So that is sentences that are above 10 years. For this episode, we're really lucky to have with us Rob Allen, who has worked in the industry for a few decades and is very experienced. He works on prison reform in the UK and also internationally. From 2005 to 2010, he was the director of the International Centre for Prison Studies, the ICPS, at King's College London. There he was undertaking research on imprisonment and assisting prison systems to comply with international standards. He has undertaken prison reform work in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and is an associate of Penal Reform International. He's written widely on criminal justice, including Reducing the Use of Imprisonment, What Can We Learn from Europe? He also co-hosts the amazing Transform Justice podcast. Rob is going to tell us all about the situation for men in prison in England. So let's hear what he has to teach us. Hi Rob, it's really great to have you here. How are you doing?
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me on, Marianne.
You've just been in Kenya, which is exciting.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to do a fair amount of international work in the kind of prison and probation and youth justice sphere over the last few years. And I've been in Kenya doing an evaluation of some work to try and improve the prison system there, undertaken by a Swedish organisation, the Raoul Wallenberg Institute. So pretty exhausting, but I'm getting back to fitness.
Yes. and back to the English weather, which is very drizzly today. Well, it would be great. I mean, you obviously work extensively in the UK as well as working all overseas, but today we're going to focus particularly on English prisons and the male ones. So we'll go into that. And it would be great if you could tell us just a bit about your background and how you began working in prisons.
Well, I've never actually worked in prisons, but I've done a lot of work sort of around prisons. When I left university, I did a year as a volunteer working with young offenders, and then worked as a social worker for several years in what was then called intermediate treatment. IT meant something rather different in those days. And intermediate treatment was about trying to keep young people out of detention centres and borstals and youth custody centres by providing supervision programmes in the community. I don't think I was terribly good at the face-to-face work, so I kind of moved down more of a sort of research and advocacy route, joined the organisation NACRO, where I worked for many years, and then became kind of more involved with adult prisoners and adults in conflict with the law, and have done various kind of research and consultancy jobs since then, including running a research centre at King's College London on prison studies. And for the last 12 or 13 years, I've been an independent researcher and consultant working on these issues, as you say, both here and in other countries.
Amazing. Thank you. Yes. And of course, we've both been independent consultants. So we've kind of circulated around each other, I feel like, but we've never actually worked directly together, have we? But I've obviously known very much about your experience and your background and all of the amazing work that you've been doing. So it's exciting to talk to you more now about your work. What kind of things have you been doing most recently, would you say?
Well, in England and Wales, I really, since I took up working for myself, I've had a series of investigations I've undertaken, and I know we'll come and talk a little bit about those later on. I've been doing a very interesting project that we're not really going to talk about, and I can't really talk about, which has been an evaluation or a review of how international war criminals are dealt with by, international tribunals in The Hague and elsewhere, specifically what happens to them when they get sentenced to prison, because the model is generally that there's no international prison in which these sentences are served. People serve their sentences in states, in countries that agree to enforce the sentences on behalf of the international tribunal. There are some in the UK, for example. There are some all over Europe and in some African countries.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. I hadn't actually thought about where these people might go.
No, it is an interesting, and it's a kind of under the radar issue. Obviously, there's rightly a lot of interest and coverage and so on about the trials of alleged perpetrators of atrocities, and these trials, of course, take many years, and when people are convicted, they appeal, and it takes a while for the sentence to be confirmed when it is, and then it rather falls off the radar what happens to people. But of course, the ones I've been looking at have been people convicted by the tribunals set up after the terrible events in former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, which happened, 30 plus years ago. So many of the people are quite elderly now, and there's a lot of issues relating to how they should be, how their sentences should be carried out, and where quite a bit of variation and so on. So it's been looking at those sort of things.
That's really interesting. It's funny, isn't it? Because actually, that's been happening in the UK as well. The prison population has got a lot older, especially with historic sexual abuse cases and things like that coming. So we're seeing a kind of change in the prison population of adult men, more towards an older population. Maybe for people who don't know much about the English and Welsh system, which is kind of linked together, the England and Wales system, if you could help explain how the estate operates, because it has quite a lot of different complications in terms of what the categories of prisons are. And we're specifically talking about the male prison estate, which is obviously the biggest estate. There's of course the women's and the young people's as well, but we'll focus on the men's. Could you help us to just kind of landscape the male prison estate and help us to understand how that works?
I'll certainly try and do that. I mean, there are about 110 prisons, I think, that take men. We've got a prison population of about 86,000. The, as you say, the vast majority men. The prison system comprises, as you say, some security categories. So there's a small number of high security prisons, which called Category A, that take the most. Well, the prisoners who are the riskiest, in the sense of they are, if their escape would be, cause serious risk to the public, and they have the possibility or capability of escaping. And then you've got category B, the next one down, which is for people who, you know, where security is still an issue, but they don't need the very highest level. Category C need less secure conditions, tend to be able to move around the prison without being escorted necessarily all the time by prison officers. And then category D, which are open prisons, where people can lead relatively normal lives, can go out to work during the day, may have a key to their room, tend to be used historically for people approaching the end of their sentences as a sort of transition to release, or for people who are very low risk. So you've got that kind of pattern, but also you've got another kind of set of categories. I mean, most people start their prison journey, if they go to prison, they may well be held on remand, so awaiting a trial, and that can take, well, it can take years in the worst cases before a trial takes place. Those, while you're on remand, you tend to be kept in a sort of, in one of the sort of city centre type prisons. So Wandsworth, Wormwood Scrubs, Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, big local prisons, they tend to be called locals. And some of those tend to be some of the older prisons. And they are ones where things can be pretty chaotic, to be honest. You've got a lot of people coming and going every day because they're taking people directly from court. People haven't really been necessarily assessed or classified or assessments made of how risky they are, what their needs are. They can be fairly noisy places where a lot of the term is churn, but a lot of comings and goings. So very difficult for people to kind of settle. And I suppose these are some of the prisons which have some of the biggest problems. We don't strictly separate people on remand from people serving sentences in England and Wales. I mean, we ought to, according to the international standards. A sentenced prisoner and a remand prisoner won't be asked to share a cell together, but they can be on the same wing and mix during the day. And I'd say that is probably the most problematic bit of the system, the bit where people are coming in and some go out. If you get a short sentence, you probably serve all of it in one of those local prisons. If you get a longer sentence, you will be transferred to a longer prison, and depending on your risks and needs, there will be an attempt to, well, certainly to put you in the right security category, but also to send you to a prison where you might be able to do some kind of rehabilitative activity that will help you to not to go back in the future.
Yeah. So there's not, I mean, to be honest, there is a limit, isn't there, to the amount of rehabilitative activity there is in general in the prisons, but you're saying there's much less in the local prisons. Is there any in the local prisons? A bit of work, isn't there?
There's a little bit of work. I mean, a lot of the people, I mean, it's still the case that there are a lot of people who go to prison for very short periods. I mean, if you look at the statistics, they don't necessarily represent a huge percentage of the people in prison on any one day. But over the course of a year, you've got a lot of people coming in and out, getting sentences of 3 months or 6 months, increasing numbers of people recalled to prison. So they've served a prison sentence or a portion of it. They've then been on released subject to some kind of supervision, on license as it's called, and then they fail to turn up to see their probation officer, or they've breached some requirement that was imposed on them before they were released, and they find themselves taken back to prison for a period of time, but often a very short period of time. So because people aren't there for very long, for those people it's really difficult to know what kind of rehabilitative activity or could really be of much use. I mean, obviously, it's better if whoever is in prison has something useful to do in their day, even if that is working as a cleaner, earning a little bit of money, working in a workshop or something. But those kind of shorter term people don't tend to be prioritized for those sorts of activities. So there is a shortage. A lot of these prisons, as I said, were built in the 19th century. They don't necessarily have the facilities, the space to provide very much. There are some exceptions, but on the whole, they're not the kind of places that can offer a great deal of opportunity for people. And in a sense, they're not designed to. They're for people waiting. Some of the other prisons, the places, particularly the Category C training prisons, are supposed to offer a range of both vocational training, work, and education opportunities. And some do that, and some do that well. The problem has been, as has been reported quite widely, we've got not only a rising prison population, but we've got a kind of race on to try and produce more prison places to put people into. One of the ways of trying to create more places is to create more places for people to sleep, so more cells, more rooms, but that doesn't necessarily come alongside more opportunities for rehabilitation. So you can, to an extent, fill prisons up with more people, but you also need more of those activity places, and that tends to be a bit neglected when there's an emergency or a crisis on. So yeah, I think there's a shortage. The amount of opportunities for people to do something useful, to learn a skill, to reflect in a structured way on why they are in prison, to try and do something to put things right, or to kind of think about how they might live their life without resorting to crime, I think those aren't on the scale that they need to be.
No, I remember when I first started working within prisons and researching them, etc., I realised just how little there actually was available when there was an assumption that there would be more. But there's certainly, you've been working in this area for a long time. Are you able to, can you give us a sense of how things have changed over the last few decades and what the critical points are now?
Oh, it's tricky because individual establishments, individual prisons, you know, have periods when they're doing okay, and then some things can change. I suppose I'd identify two or three things, and it's fairly well known to people who've been in the system. I mean, in the austerity years, in the early 2010 to 14, 15, there was a big kind of fall in the numbers of staff, really, in order to meet sort of reduced spending targets. There was a lot of experienced staff left, and the numbers of staff really did decline, and prisons, a lot of prisons found themselves in difficulty. Though it coincided with a period when the new psychoactive substances, spice, and these kinds of things got into certainly some prisons in quite a big way. And I think in that middle period of that decade, a lot of prisons, I'm talking 2014 to 2018, it was really difficult for a lot of prisons. There were a lot of prisoners who were involved not only in this taking these drugs, but the whole kind of market involved around them. So prisoners getting into debt that could produce violence. There weren't necessarily experienced staff who were able to intervene and cope with all of that. And prisons recovered up to a point in that staff were kind of recruited, but inspection reports from the local monitors and from the chief inspector of prisons who visits places have found that, you know, a lot of the staff are young, which is not bad in itself, but perhaps lack some of that guile and jailcraft, they call it, the experience to be able to know how to deal with with conflicts, with prisoners who were unhappy. We had the introduction of this pepper spray, Parva, which is used to incapacitate prisoners. Not, I don't think, used as much as some people had feared, and not necessarily with some of the negative consequences. But a number of sort of security things have been introduced, like dogs being used on landings to keep control. So I think because there was a bit of a major problem of control within prisons in that period, steps were taken then to deal with that, which had to be done in the absence of enough staff, I think. Then we had COVID, of course, which meant that prisoners were really, we were all locked down. They were locked up and locked down, and really had spent a lot of time in their cells and already restricted regimes and activities and opportunities became yet more restricted. And since the end of lockdown, there's been a kind of, how should I put it? Well, first of all, some of the people in prisons, some of the staff and governors sort of thought, actually, having prisoners locked up in their cells a lot of the time did make things a lot more peaceful. So there was less violence, there was less trouble. Self-harm is another story, of course, and the toll that being locked up in a prison cell for long periods takes on mental health and so on, I'm not sure has really fully been appreciated. But anyway, as things opened up in society, so too they did in prisons, though perhaps not as quickly or as suddenly. But nonetheless, sadly, some of the problems that were around preceding the COVID period seem to have come back again. So we have got real concern. I mean, the chief inspector found more than half of prisoners in one prison he reported on last week or the week before said they were taking drugs in prison. So drugs seem to be getting into prisons despite quite a lot of efforts to stop them. Violence, self-harm, all these indicators of a prison struggling, and of course, more importantly, indicators of real sort of suffering and misery on the part of prisoners and of staff, seem to have returned with a vengeance. So I think, I mean, the words crisis and prisons are perhaps overused, but I think it's not much of an over-exaggeration to say that the system is in crisis. And I mean, one of the papers was saying that prison staff are now going to be issued with tasers in order to control prisoners. And I guess you have to ask, is that the kind of model of imprisonment we ought to be aspiring to in this country, or whether we could do something better?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is so depressing. I mean, I certainly don't agree with that. I think that the kind of human-to-human approach to security seems to be the much better way to do it. I remember we were doing some research in a Category C prison around the time that you were saying that kind of the majority of the staff had already left, the older staff had left and the newer staff had come in, but there was a chronic lack of staff. It was almost impossible for the prison to unlock the prisoners to go to any activities because there was every day a shortage of staff. And we were doing an evaluation of programs that were meant to be operating, rehabilitative programs that were meant to be operating, but they couldn't take place most days because they just weren't able to be out of their cells. So they were just in their cells all the time. And it really felt like an awful environment at that time. And yes, of course, this idea that you are, I guess, kind of inexperienced, more scared, but can't feel that you, and there aren't enough of you, where you have to kind of resort to these more extreme measures of things like tasers or these kind of like coercive methods of security just speak to the fact that we're just getting it so wrong. It's not it's not the way that it needs to be, because of course if you develop relationships with people, you can kind of create a completely different environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the kind of key findings, or the sort of really top level academic studies, the Alison Liebling, Ben Crewe, the Cambridge people have found that this issue of relationships between staff and prisoners is absolutely crucial to to how prisons run. And of course, it's very hard if there aren't enough. If prison staff aren't able to kind of respond well to legitimate requests from prisoners for certain things, because, you know, prisons, you've worked in them, Marianne, you know them. They're a strange mix, aren't they, of, on the one hand, very controlled environments in the sense that, you know, prisoners can't move, they can't open doors, they can't often get from A to B, or certain of their choices are very highly restricted. But yet alongside that, they have a sense of being rather uncontrolled environments in which, you know, people are shouting, people are in and out of each other's cells sometimes, you know, in some prisons quite openly smoking, you know, drugs, or there are things going on. So it's this very sort of strange paradox of the controlled and the uncontrolled that always strikes me when I go to visit prisons.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, the controlled and uncontrolled. I definitely always feel the controlled element, because I think it's really interesting how quickly I and the team I've, you know, when we've had a team as well, have got so institutionalized that we kind of stand outdoors and wait for the doors to be open. You know, you spend a day going around a prison having doors open for you, and then you come out and you kind of forget that you have the power to open a door yourself, you know, and certainly feeling, I guess, as also as a having worked or well, having kind of my first experience being in Pentonville when I did work experience, because I wanted to be a fast track prison governor. That was one of my first ideas of a job. And then I kind of got scared out of it by this very kind of, I don't know, intimidating manager who kind of said, "Do you think you could manage me, young girl?" And it was kind of less the prison environment and more him, where I was like, actually, I don't know if I could. And yeah, but just kind of feeling like you do, there's definitely an atmosphere, there's definitely not a sense of safety, there's definitely a sense that you kind of have to, I felt like I had to kind of give off a tough or at least a confident persona whenever I walk around, because you just sense that you need to show that you're not somehow to be kind of victimized. So it is a very, yeah, it is a very horrible environment as well. And then certainly, as you said, all of these things like people shouting out of windows. I remember this prison I was talking about with the Category C prison, just rubbish everywhere, people throwing things out of the windows because there's nothing for them to do. They couldn't really get out. Things kind of hanging from the windows. It's not a nice place to be, is it? And the environment itself, usually concrete, usually high walls, usually grey. I don't know, there's something really oppressive about the environment. I remember always feeling when I've gone into a prison environment, just really always being glad to get out, because it's an impressive place to be. It's not nice. They're not nice to be in, are they?
Yeah, no, they're not. I mean, in a sense, they're not supposed to be nice. I mean, one of the other paradoxes is that we talk about trying to make prisons positive experiences for people, to give people opportunities, this term rehabilitation that means, well, who knows really what it means, but at least trying to equip people with the possibility of trying to change their ways in a sense. But at the end of the day, a prison is partly there to inflict pain on people. I mean, there's this saying that you're sent to prison sort of as a punishment, not for a punishment. But, you know, there is this sort of sense, it's not often articulated, that really if we offer too many opportunities to prisoners, then, you know, won't people want to go to prison to take them? This sort of doctrine of less eligibility, the idea that conditions in prison treatment of prisoners needs to be sort of worse than treatment outside prison. In all sorts of ways, a kind of depressing doctrine, but it's kind of there in the ether a bit, I think. And, you know, you sometimes see that when the media will cover, I remember years and years ago, there was some kind of event, I think it might have been in a women's prison, but some kind of, it wasn't a party, but it was some sort of entertainment event that was going on there, and the media got hold of it and said, what on earth are these prisoners doing? You know, I think it was some special occasion, New Year's Eve or something. And there was a sort of predictable crackdown on those kinds of activities because we can't have prisoners enjoying themselves. Or so I think, you know, that kind of approach rears its head from time to time in terms of prison. But for the most of the time, yes, you're right. It's a depressing kind of environment. It's an unvarying environment. Many prisoners, you know, struggle really with the boredom of, you know, very little to do, you know, punctuated by ghastly events of, you know, of sudden violence, of people harming themselves, and equally for staff, you know, they will have to rush and deal with some awful scenes, and that's it day in, day out.
Yeah, you mentioned that it can be pretty ghastly, and we're going to talk more about the issue of near deaths, which I think is really interesting. I didn't actually think about this as an issue. I have obviously thought about suicide in prison and assaults in prison and all of these kind of things, but near deaths as a category of violence is quite, well, it's what certainly one that you've been much more involved in. So could you tell us a bit about what these are, what kind of things are near deaths, and how do they come about in a general sense?
Yeah, I mean, it is a fairly morbid topic in a way, but it's one that I got involved with because I was asked, well, for the first time about 15 years ago, if I would be interested in leading an independent investigation into a near death in prison. And this, in fact, it was in a women's prison, the first one I did. But in those kinds of cases, in fact, I think the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that there ought to be an independent investigation in the same way as there would be if somebody dies in prison. So if somebody dies, there is an inquest, so a coroner will look into the circumstances and, where necessary, produce a report saying what needs to be done to prevent future deaths. There's also the prison ombudsman who undertakes an inquiry to try and extract any learning that the prison service needs. But the category of cases where an independent investigation is needed was extended to include cases where people, you know, almost died and also sustained life-changing injuries, which mean that, you know, they're unable to effectively live an independent life. So I've done 7 or 8 of these investigations over the years, often cases where people have tried to kill themselves, or in 2 of the cases, they've involved serious assaults where a prisoner has assaulted another prisoner and the prisoner hasn't died as a result, but has sustained these life-changing injuries. And so it's been a question of looking into really 2 things. One is the actual incident itself, how that happened. Was there anything that might have been done to prevent it on the day or in the hours and minutes leading up to it? How was the response to it by prison staff, by healthcare staff, and so on? But also, and in a sense, in the cases I've done, perhaps more importantly, looking at the sort of the build up to it. What did the prison and the healthcare, because mental health is often an issue in these cases, was the provision of healthcare services, was the way the prison dealt with the problems that these individuals were displaying beforehand, how well was that done? Could things have been done differently? Should the person have been in prison at all, in that particular prison, in that particular part of the prison? Those kinds of questions. We come up with findings and recommendations, which, you know, hopefully would lead to some kind of improvement going forward. And they do, you know, they do shed a light, you know, sometimes quite a disturbing light on, you know, on what prison is like in individual cases where things go wrong, as it were. I mean, one case I remember, it was a man with serious mental health difficulties. I mean, quite a lot of the investigations I've done have, as I mentioned, have sort of featured mental health. And it's, you know, it's really made me think that, you know, there are many people in prisons who should probably be in other settings, in healthcare settings, given the extent and nature of their mental illnesses. So we're talking about people with, you know, schizophrenia or psychotic illnesses, on antipsychotic drugs. In the case of one of the investigations, this chap, they would not prescribe the right antipsychotic drug for him. The prescription seemed to fall between the stools of the primary care, the GP, the mental health team and the drugs team, all of whom saw this chap, but they could not seem to get it together. They all seemed to think that one of the other parties was doing the prescription. And so this chap's psychotic symptoms got worse and worse, and he ended up barricading himself into his cell, tying a ligature at the back of his cell and trying to hang himself. And when the staff arrived, they couldn't open the door. He barricaded it so they couldn't open the cell door inwards to get in. There's a way in which cell doors can be opened outwards. You apply a tool and change the way the door opens. But unfortunately, that didn't work because the place where you apply this tool to change the way the door opens was bunged up with paint or blue tack or I don't know what. They had to get a maintenance guy. The maintenance guy was having his lunch. He didn't realize it was a serious incident. So in the meantime, these staff are watching this guy at the back of the cell through the cell door. It was ghastly. One of those things where, you know, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Eventually, they got in there, they managed to get the guy down. But he had incurred very serious kind of brain damage and has been in kind of, as far as I know, in under constant care since then. But, you know, in that kind of case, there were lots of issues. There was the prescription of the proper medication. Obviously, as in many cases, this guy was not an easy guy, partly because he wasn't getting his medication. So he was occasionally violent. He assaulted other prisoners, staff, I think. And he would then appear before the disciplinary system in prisons and would get some sort of punishment. So he might have his television removed. He might be placed in a more restrictive environment, confined to his cell. All things that, in a sense, if you wanted to design something to make his mental health worse, that's the sort of thing you'd do. So it really, it just showed the limitations of this, of the kind of prison approach to dealing with somebody, you know, of this nature. And I mean, the worst thing in a sense in that case was the fact that he had a sister who had effectively been his carer in the community, who had been very, very supportive to this man. And she was on at the prison, you know, telling them that he needed olanzapine, this particular medication, telling them when she'd had a visit and he didn't seem right. And she was very assiduous and very caring and so on. But the response from the prison really wasn't as good as it should have been, in the sense that they didn't really work in partnership with her to try and keep her brother safe and, you know, try to come up with a better outcome for everybody. And that was a very sad aspect of it. You know, there are many prisoners that don't have people kind of advocating on their behalf like that. This man had, and that's why it was, you know, it was distressing that her warnings and, you know, her attempts to try and get the prison to do things largely, you know, fell on deaf ears.
That's horrible. And you said that he is now, so what is he, kind of in a coma or something? Or
Well, he was in a coma when I did the investigation, which was a few years ago, and I don't know what his current state is, but the prognosis wasn't great at that point. And that, you know, the threshold for doing these investigations is quite a high one. So we're talking about people who are extremely unlikely to recover. They may improve a little bit in terms of their condition, but their lives as they'd known them, you know, were at an end, and it was a very different kind of a life that they were living. Gosh.
What you're saying just highlights so much, doesn't it, how the prison is this rigid system which kind of tries to fit people in it, and you either have to kind of conform to it or you somehow bounce around it in a kind of, you know, state of kind of unrest, and the lack that it has of trying to understand people's individual complexities and try and design something that might actually, you know, help them on an individual level and help them and help society on a broader level. It's so frustrating because, as you said, the sister was saying, and they just were ignoring her, and almost you just get this sense that it's just not set up in that way, is it? It's set up as a rigid thing to control and contain, and if, you know, it either break, you know, it breaks you, it's built to break you, and it's not built to really try and have more of a long-term thought about how can we really genuinely help to change people's behavior or help society.
Yeah. I mean, there are systems of kind of assessment. There is this process called OASIS, Offender Assessment System, that's supposed to identify the kind of needs and the risks of people in prison have. It doesn't tend to be applied to people serving very short sentences. It is used for people serving longer sentences, but it takes a while to do. And, you know, sometimes there can be horrible consequences arising from not properly undertaking assessments at a very early stage. I mean, in another of the investigations I did, it was an assault, serious assault by one prisoner who had recently been admitted to prison. He was charged with murder, I think, of a relative, not a murder of a stranger, and some mental health issues had been identified. But again, from memory, one of his family had contacted the prison to say, look, we're really concerned about what happened here. You know, he's been involved in this incident which led to the death of a family member. You really need to watch him because he, you know, has got some serious delusions and so on. And there was a kind of an assessment process cranking into action, but really, and he was placed into a part of the prison which was designed to offer a more sheltered environment for people with vulnerabilities and mental health problems. But actually the risks that this guy was, you know, turned out to have were very much higher than those which were identified by the prison, and he seriously assaulted another prisoner on an exercise yard. Again, it's one of these multifaceted incidents. So on this unit, there were supposed to be two or even three staff on duty, certainly two. There was just one. Exercise time came, so everybody's entitled to at least an hour out of their cells in fresh air. So the officer unlocks everybody's and then supervising them on the small exercise yard. And then two or three of them ask to go back to their cells before the hour is up. He takes them back, but this leaves these two on the exercise yard. And that's the moment at which the perpetrator took the opportunity to just turn on the other prisoner and seriously assault him, leaving him in a really, well, close to death. He recovered. And in a sense, I felt, of course, terrible for the, well, for everybody, particularly the victim, of course, who had done nothing wrong. But the prison officer was faced with an impossible choice. Really, he should have not allowed those people out on exercise at all, because there was only one of him. He wasn't going to be able to provide the right level of supervision. But yet, I think he was trying to do what he thought was the right thing, to give people an opportunity to get out of their cell for an hour. He thought he knew the risks because the chap who ended up committing the assault had been in the prison by that stage for a little while, not for very long, but he hadn't shown any signs up till that point of violence or threats of violence. So it came as a bit of a shock. But nonetheless, the officer's, decision, which he made genuinely to try and do what he thought was right, kind of blew up in his face, because the moment his back was turned escorting these other prisoners back, this disaster happened. And again, it's one of those things that, with hindsight, things might have been done differently, but there should have been more staff on duty on the day. The assessment of the perpetrator should have perhaps taken account of the fact that he had, or was charged with, a very, the most serious offence of homicide, that a member of his family was alerting the prison to the fact that there were some serious risks likely to emerge for this chap. And again, it wasn't, the response just wasn't sort of quick enough or agile enough to those warning signs. Again, hindsight, of course, it's easy. And I mean, I'm doing these investigations, I'm looking back, and with the benefit of all of the information, and you have to put yourself into the position of the people there and then, not looking back on it, of course. But I think in both of the cases I've talked about, there were enough signs for other steps to have been taken, but sadly they weren't.
They're both horrible cases. What it makes me think of is just also that horribleness of being on the ground and being that one staff member or whatever who had the decision to take between either letting people out their cell where otherwise they would have been in their rooms for, 24 hours a day or not. And it just strikes me that these people who are on the front line, their behaviors get looked into, but then actually they're just the tiny pinpoint of a massive system and a massive structure, which does contain a lot of violence in it. I feel like the whole system is quite, as you say, it's based on punishment, it's based to kind of cause pain. And so that whole structure and that whole environment is there almost, it is a violent structure, in my opinion. And yet, all we can really do is look at these cases where the worst case happens. But it's almost like that's just a tiny, tip of the iceberg, and all of the stuff that's underneath it and that supports it is a problem as well. And we don't get to challenge that so much.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, as I'm sure you have, and it's always struck me as odd that prisons, okay, they have changed. Of course, they've changed in all sorts of ways, but fundamentally, they haven't really changed in terms of what they're doing. And if you walked into a prison 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you'd immediately recognize what you were in. And I mean, it's one of the frustrations I've got. The government are currently embarking on this huge prison building program. So there are going to be 20,000 new prison places. But for me, that's maybe we do need some more prison places, but I would prefer at least some of that funding to go into more hospital places, more places for, you know, halfway houses, other kinds of institutions or semi-institutions, or just supporting people in the community to try and deal with these problems that society faces. Putting it all into, you know, more prison places seems to me a real wasted opportunity to diversify the response that we might want to make when people get into the criminal justice system. They need sanctions, they need a response from society, but just relying on this same old response that we've used really for hundreds of years is I think a failure of imagination more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree it's a failure of imagination. For me, I see it just so much based on fear, and most of our policy and institutions around crime are based on fear, but it's almost a paranoid fear to a certain extent, and it kind of assumes that the way to stop it is through controlling as much as possible, when actually that's not been shown to work, and it's not a long-term solution, because effectively you're creating most of the people that are within the system have had some kind of intense trauma, and to create another more traumatic system does just, you know, it emphasizes the point and just makes the whole situation worse. I think it's, for me, I mean, my opinion, and I do lean more towards abolitionist than not, is that we just have the wrong goal in mind when we think about prison. I don't think punishment is necessarily the cleverest goal. I think what we really want is to make society safer and nicer, and to keep communities together. Whereas I feel like the way that we isolate and contain prisoners at the moment doesn't do anything to actually help us to come together as a society and heal as a society. It just tries to push the situation into a small box, and it doesn't really do anything. So, and we know, you know, that there are so many different models. There are more therapeutic models. There are different ways of constructing the prison estate in terms of even just smaller buildings, more homely buildings, more multidisciplinary teams. All of these kind of things have been shown to work. And yet, as you say, we just keep building these high buildings. Just this idea that, you know, prisoners, as you say, even in those death situations, where all those near-death situations, it's that prisoners are kind of like hot potatoes between healthcare and the security. You know, they're kind of, no one really wants to look after them. In fact, nobody wants to look after them ever. They're the most difficult people in the world to think about. And so I feel like, why don't we have the sharpest minds, knowledgeable people who have emotional and intellectual intelligence helping with people, rather than just like shoving them into boxes with loads of people who have hardly any training? It just feels so anti-logical.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what you say, and that's what I think that's what I was trying to say about the failure of imagination. Certainly, I think the imagination could encompass, you know, a much wider range of responses, including, as you say, a kind of different philosophical response to wrongdoing, as it were. But for me, I've become a little bit narrower in terms of just looking at the range of types of response. I mean, there's a big, I went to a conference last year in Belgium where they are really taking seriously the idea of much smaller scale, what they call detention houses. So, you know, places which might take 50 to 100 people. Mm. You know, our new prisons that we're building here are 2,000. Okay, they're broken down into smaller scale living units. But I think, you know, scale is an important issue if you're going to have prisons. You know, having, I remember a few years ago, probably only 3 years ago, I saw that a new probation hostel was being built. I think it was in Bristol. I can't exactly remember. And it said it was the first new probation hostel in 30 years. Mm. Well, in 30 years, you know, we'd built something like 20 plus thousand prison places.
Yeah.
So having a kind of a much more balanced kind of landscape of responses, you know, yes, some prisons, but more hospitals, shelters, halfway houses, community responses, a kind of spectrum, a full spectrum response. And we've not had the balance. We've put too much into the prison end of things and not enough across the rest of the spectrum. And I think that's the bit that needs looking at. I mean, it's not easy because there will be kind of contrasts in the philosophies. And you know, to their credit, when prisons have been able to concentrate on things other than just managing the population and the numbers, there has been some diversification, some units within prisons, you know, psychologically informed units to try and provide something like a therapeutic community. And there are a handful of those. There's Grendon, which is the one sort of therapeutic prison that we've had, but there's never been a kind of another one. So there are some little glimpses of what might be, but I just think it's not, they're a kind of an extra or an add-on. But having that more diverse, innovative approach ought to be more central to how prisons are run, rather than what we were talking about earlier, which was walking onto a wing smelling of stale cabbage and shouting and banging doors and all of that. That's what, you know, the bulk of prison places are like, not these more interesting and innovative and almost certainly likely to be more effective types of environment that could be created.
Yeah, I think it's just, criminal justice is frustrating because it seems very much a particular place where it's not based, policymaking is not based on evidence, it's based on, yeah, as I said, kind of knee-jerk fear and as you said, a failure of imagination. We've done research and evaluations of multidisciplinary teams and these are much more interesting ways of dealing with people who have committed crimes. You just see that they're more effective and they can be more effective, but it's just, I don't know, people just want to like bolt the door and run away and pretend it's not happening.
Yeah. You know, back to the beginning of this conversation, you asked me sort of how I got into this, and I told you in a fairly sort of narrative way. But the bit I didn't answer was why I've continued to be interested in it. And I think that the reason is because it does throw up so many, you know, fundamental kind of issues, really, about how we organize ourselves as a society and how we deal with people who don't play by the rules for whatever reason, or when incidents happen, things happen, how are we going to best respond? And so there's that kind of, I mean, it sounds a bit pompous, but there is that sort of philosophical element to all of this in terms of what we're doing when we lock people up and work with them in prisons and try to find better ways. And I think that's, you know, that's partly why I've stayed, you know, so interested by it, this feeling that there must be a better way. Although, you know, much of the time one feels it's a struggle to find it, to package it, to get it and to get movement on it. But I mean, most of the people, as you know, in this field are optimists, in you have to be, really, and are always hoping, probably rather in the face of experience, that things can only get better.
Well, no, indeed, it is a hard area to work in, particularly as as you get older. I felt like I don't know quite how people have managed to stay at it for so long, but it does still keep being compelling and important. Thank you so much, Rob, for shedding light on everything you have and for the work that you've been doing, and especially this work around near deaths. And that can't be an easy thing to look into and work on. So thanks so much for sharing your experiences with that. It's been really, really interesting to chat to you.
No, I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Marianne.
Is there any way that people can follow you, find out more about your work?
Yeah, I mean, I do a blog, and then I do the Transform Justice podcast with Penelope Gibbs sporadically. So, I mean, those are the best ways of getting hold of me.
Definitely, I would endorse also the Transform Justice podcast. It's a really, really good podcast. I've been listening recently to that, and you go in depth into certain issues as well. For example, you went into the Postmaster scandal as well, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
So we'll definitely follow all of those things. And thank you again, Rob.
Not at all. No, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic, and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.